a boutique and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
Hi, it's Sunday, 5 o'clock, and this is Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and in this semi-weekly radio show, I have conversations with people engaged in ecology, environment, sustainability, and society projects. As I've said before, our focus is primarily on the Monterey Bay region, but sometimes we'll range as far afield as California and beyond. Today we're not going very far because my guest is Dr. Jim Clifford, Distinguished Professor Emeritus in History of Consciousness and Humanities up at UC Santa Cruz. Clifford received his PhD in European Intellectual and Social History from Harvard in 1977, and he has written on the intellectual history of anthropology, amongst other things. This is really important today because the university is really a kind of an anthropological site, and I'm having him here to talk, to offer his insights on the place. More recently, he's become a photographer of the campus and recently published An Uncommon Place, a book of environmental photos taken on the campus, along with essays about the university. It's a really nice piece of work.
Wrong title.
We'll fix it then.
In the Ecotone, oh, right. The UC Santa Cruz campus.
Oh, well. Today we're going to have a conversation about the city's elephant on the hill, UCSC, and its environmental and natural history, as well as its impact on the city over the past 60 years. But before we start, I want to announce a couple of events that are coming up. The first one is on climate disruption with Dar Jamail, Greg Castro, and Canyon Coyote Women Sayers Roods, which is happening at Cabrillo College on October the 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. in room 450. Admission is free. And the other one is sponsored by Sustainable Pacific Grove, down in Pacific Grove. It's Before the Flood. I believe it's a film, and it is taking place on Wednesday, October 9th at 7 p.m. at the Pacific Grove Community Center. All right. So why don't we get started with the conversation? Welcome to Sustainability Now, Jim.
Thank you, Ronnie.
It's always a pleasure to see you and to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Where should we start? The university, as I said, is a big presence in the city. It sits up on the hill, the city on mm-hmm. a hill, but it inevitably has all kinds of impacts on the city. And the university, the germ of the university, was conceived more than 60 years ago by Clark Kerr, who was then president of the University of California, mm-hmm. With his associate Dean McHenry, who ended up becoming the first chancellor of UCSC. Maybe we should start by talking about how the site was chosen.
Sure. I think it's good to spend a little time on the history of the place because since I've gotten interested in the history of UC Santa Cruz, I've learned a lot of things I didn't know and unmade quite a few rather facile and stereotypic ideas I had about, the beauty of the place and this and that, and or its naturalness, And talking to people, I found that a lot of people don't know much about the history of the place. So as UC Santa Cruz was one of three campuses that were founded, all opened around 1965. Irvine, Riverside, and UCSC, and they were responses by the university to the baby boomers, a demographic wave that they could see was going to need college. It was going to need a university, and they built three campuses. Now, that's, stop and think about that. Three campuses. That was Pat Brown, the governor, said, okay, let's have three campuses, and they built three campuses. Since then, they, in 55 years, they have built one new campus, which is why we have a problem of over-enrollments today.
You know, I spent the last year doing some research on this, and it turns out that the planners vastly overestimated the impact of the baby boom. But what's more interesting is that all three campuses were sited, were located in rapidly growing counties, locations, because of white flight to the suburbs. Yeah. I mean, if you actually look at the statistics, what you see is that the people coming in had been coming from urban locations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, not 10 years later, the demography of California started to change quite radically.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. And why it got to UC, why it came to Santa Cruz, a sleepy little town on the coast, is something we'll get to in a moment. What I just wanted to underline when I was stressing those three campuses like that is that the money was there. And we were at the end of the post-war boom when in the capitalist West, the normal rules of capitalism, which is boom and bust, were suspended for 30 years, and it just went up and up and up and up. And that boom, this campus, and all three campuses are a product of the post-war boom, which was essentially the peace of the victors in World War II, and it lasted until the mid-70s. But in the mid-70s, global recession, the oil shock, all of that, and after that, capitalism went back to its usual boom and bust, up and down pattern, and the funding for places like UCSC went into secular decline, in fact, for the whole UC campus, for the whole UC system. So there's a kind of political economic story, a structural story that underlies the sort of hopeful beginnings of UCSC, a kind of crisis in the mid-late 70s when suddenly all growth ended, building ended, and then a kind of pattern of growth always based on grow, 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 oops, money disappears, shrink, 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 grow, 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 shrink, shrink, shrink. That's the Santa Cruz I've known over 35 years here, and always growing ahead of resources with the promise the resources would catch up, but they never quite do. And that was just a different political economic moment than the moment that created this campus, which was one of post-war optimism.
Why do you think Irvine and San Diego have done so much better in this respect?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that they were just better at fundraising, at finding money in not waiting for the money to come from the University of California according to the formulas that they impose. And UC Santa Cruz, for probably ideological reasons, was just too pure to do that kind of thing. You know, fundraising, oh, that was for bourgeois other campuses, and now we've gotten into it, but kind of too late.
You know, my sort of feeling, and this is true of Santa Barbara too, is that those campuses are located in fairly well-off communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The alternative site was in the Almaden Valley, and after this past year, I've come to conclude that would have been a much better choice, but of course it's too late for that.
Well, now you're raising the question about why it ended up on a hilltop down here in a honky-tonk town, and I say a politically conservative town in those days, really Republican, although Republicans could be progressive in those days. It wasn't like Republicans today. I mean, they could be all gung-ho for creating Cabrillo College and a UC campus. Those were Republicans who were doing that, who were gung-ho for that kind of, bringing that kind of education here. But why this, to come to this small town at the end of a twisty road, difficult access, there's many stories that go with that, and we don't have to retell them all about how they brought the Regents down to look at the site, and it was a beautiful day, and they just fell in love with it for essentially aesthetic reasons. And then they took them over to see the competing site, which was the so-called Almadene property around San Jose. And it was brutally hot, and they couldn't take their air-conditioned bus up to where they needed to go, and everybody suffered. And, well, the answer was clear. It had to come to UC Santa Cruz. But it was that, and it's also that they got a really sweet deal from the Cowell Foundation, who essentially gave them the land, and land that was all a single parcel. The Almadene competing property was in several or many parcels, and they would have had to deal with a whole lot of different owners, one of them the Catholic Church. And everything was going to be a lot easier if they came to Santa Cruz. The third thing was that it was being driven by Clark Kerr, who had developed a vision of UC Santa Cruz as an alternate campus. It was going to be the alter Berkeley. Berkeley had gotten too big. It was impersonal, as Mario Savio several years later said, you know, this is the multiversity, it's impersonal. We the students are cogs in a machine, as he said. Mm-hmm. Clark Kerr understood that, and since he had gone to Swarthmore, he was attracted to the idea of small college liberal arts education. So he said, we'll create a different kind of campus with colleges, which would be like little Swarthmores, and it would be a UC campus with a research university, but it would feel small. So the idea of a city on a hill up on this hilltop and not too big was attractive. So for all these reasons, it ended up here. But to follow up on your point about how maybe it would have been better if it had actually been over in San Jose, when the vote was taken by the regents between the two sites, Santa Cruz won overwhelmingly, but there were two dissenting votes, and they were one of them was Pat Brown, the governor, and the other was, I forget his name, the lieutenant governor. And these were people who understood that a university needed to be where the people were and where the resources were. Right. And in retrospect now, as the pressure is on UC Santa Cruz to service the state, to take more students, et cetera, and where we're coming up the constraints of the site, in retrospect, it's starting to look like maybe it would have been better had they not brought it here. But the die is cast, and they did something pretty extraordinary, I think.
Let's come back to that, because I want to talk about this site. We have to take a short break.
Sure.
This is KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM and ksquid.org on the web, the ink spot on your radio dial. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Professor Emeritus Jim Clifford, and we're talking about UCSC, its history, its environmental impact, perhaps its future.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the site itself, okay? Which, of course, when students come here, they're mesmerized, as was I when I came 30 years ago, because it really is this beautiful place in the forest, and you see all these big redwoods, and it's only later you learn that the place was clear-cut 100 years ago, that it was the site of various industries. So, I mean, I tell students, this is really a sort of brownfield industrial site that's been, you know, in a sense, rehabilitated.
Yeah.
So, but can you say something about this place?
Well, what you say is all completely true. I mean, the idea of pristine nature, it makes absolutely no sense here. And it didn't even from the beginning. I mean, the California Indians who lived in this site before there were any white people were altering the site. They were using fire to burn the undergrowth so that the oak communities on which they depended would bear more acorns. I mean, they were already tending the site. It was already a kind of a garden. And then when ranching, big deal, and timber, you know, logging, and then most important, really, the lime industry. And that's something that I sort of knew about, and you see the ruined lime kilns around campus, and you think, oh, well, yeah, they burned a little lime. It wasn't a little lime. It was a lot of lime. And at one point, the Cowell Ranch was one of the two or three largest lime-producing industrial operations in the whole country. And lime is used in making cement and all sorts of building materials. So that when San Francisco earthquake, when it burned in 1906, it had to be rebuilt. And a lot of it was rebuilt with cement and products that came from this ranch. It was pretty amazing. And how do you cook lime? You need a lot of wood to cook lime, and that's where a lot of those redwood trees went.
You know, actually mentioning lime, the geology of the site is quite interesting, and it has an enormous impact on how the university is designed. Mm-hmm. It sits on limestone left behind from a sea that was here about 60 million years ago, I think it was, right? And there are some caverns. Now, this is not like limestone in Florida, full of water and deeply pitted with caverns, right? It's much, much drier. Mm-hmm. But one of the features is that erosion has taken place to produce the canyons that crisscross the campus, okay? Yeah. So that's a feature of the campus. Yeah. And talk about the design then.
Well, just that on that one point, because I think it took me a long time to put two and two together. You know, these ravines, these canyons, you can walk across a bridge after a week of torrential rain and look down into the canyons, and you won't see water down there. What's wrong with this picture? Where does it go? Well, the limestone formation you're talking about, it's called karst, and it's like a big sponge. And it is kind of light and an absorbent. And all the water that hits this campus and the meadows around it is just absorbed. And it goes down into an aquifer, it comes out in springs downhill. Why is it called Spring Street, for example? You know, there are lots of springs down there. So the whole underground water system here. But karst is also not that strong, and it fails, it's cavernous, and we have sinkholes all over campus. Right at the corner of Hagar and Coolidge on the way in, there's a big sinkhole, if you ever see the depression there. There's one right behind the library. If you go down the little road behind the library, you'll suddenly see a big hole there. And what's that? With, you know, redwood trees growing out of it now. And all this water drains down there, and then it just disappears. And there's another one right next to Cal Health. There's one right next to, we used to call it... Bascom Engineering. You know, these are big, big old sinkholes, but they're actually all over the place, which makes it very hard to build here, because every building you plan, there has to first be a very elaborate testing to see whether there's enough ground down there to support it. So that's all part of the complexity of building in this environment. There's the ruggedness of the ravines. There's the fact of the redwoods, which, though they were clear-cut around in the turn of the century, are now getting pretty big. And there are probably more redwoods now than there were when the university was founded. People are always saying, oh, you're killing off all the redwoods. Not exactly. You know, of course we cut down redwoods to put 18,000-student university up here. But they're also growing, and there are a lot of redwoods still thriving. So it's a complicated transition. And as you said, it's a kind of second nature that's growing back here. It's nothing primal or original. Everything was altered by human intervention.
But of course, you know, who remembers it, right? We come here without any awareness or memory. Mm-hmm. Well, so the initial plan was to build a 27,500 student campus, mostly on the lower part of the current campus, because it was much easier to build there. And what happened as a result of that?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, just to pick up on a previous point, 27,500 students were planned for this university, and the date of completion in the first long-range development plan was 1990. In fact, in 1990, there were about 7,000 students here, not 27,000, and we haven't gotten close to it yet. The reason being that what now seems like an insane projection of rapid growth, that reflects that moment of the boom. That's boom thinking, you know? Hey, just grow, 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 grow. and nothing will stop us. Well, why did they not build a campus out in the Meadows, which would have been cheaper and in a way more and easier? And if we had done that, we would have had a sort of little UC Riverside sitting in the Meadows, and it would be a cookie-cutter campus. It would look just like other campuses. There'd probably be a clock tower or a campanile in the middle and radiating. You can imagine what it might look like. But in fact, the decision was made to move it into I call it the ecotone, which is a technical term for the transition zone between ecologies, the forest ecology and the grasslands ecology, and the transition zone. And that is, was to move it into the ecotone and build there a very rugged and complicated landscape. And the reason, and that decision was driven really largely by one man named Thomas Church, who, if you were a landscape architect or an architect in California, you would know that name. He was very well known in the 1950s. He invented the California landscape style, which is based not on which is based on using the topography and the plant life and building in and with it, and leaving as much of it as possible. And in some ways, the sort of suburban ranch house, which he invented that along with William Worcester, a famous architect of the time, who was his kind of partner. They invented the California ranch house and the landscaping that went with it. So that was, he was best known for that. But he happened to, for a while, live in Scotts Valley. He and Worcester designed Paso Tiempo Estates, which is one of the early suburban, Northern California-style suburban projects. That was in the 1930s. And by the 50s, they were famous, and he was famous. But he knew the Cal Ranch, and he knew the site, and he really cared about it. And he said, listen, he became the advising executive architect for the entire project. And he had a lot of prestige. Many of the regents bowed down to him because he made half of their gardens anyway. And he was a really wonderful guy, actually, who really felt that building needed to be in sympathy and in scale with the physical environment. It should not impose on the environment. And so he always opposed radical ground clearing and earth moving and all of that. And his plan for the campus here was, once he had convinced the regents to move it into the ecotone, which took a little convincing because it was more expensive, but he did. And there the idea was, look, we have this amazing site. When he would say, when you talk about the site here, what do you remember? What do you say? Oh, the splendid views out over all the bay, the open fields, the redwoods. He said, why would we want to destroy that by putting a university into the open fields? No, let's leave them and preserve that sense of openness and space as a prelude to this wonderfully complex environment inside the ecotone, inside the trees, and also the rugged ravines with those wonderful footbridges and everything. So he had a vision of a much more interesting kind of architecture, in his view, the physical environment was the architecture, in other words. And he wrote a very influential memo, which is, I republish it in my book because it's such a great piece of writing. He wrote this wonderful memo to the architect saying, do not compete with the site, because the site is going to win anyway. So make the site part of your architecture, make your architecture part of the site, and so that's why we have, that's why the trees are so close to the buildings here. That's why there were certain rules about scale, for example. Nothing could be taller than the 2/3 of the nearest large redwood. Mm-hmm. The idea of scale was very important to him. No monster buildings, no clearing out of space and building a Frank Gehry-like, sculptural building there. Uh-uh. It was much more a sense of the physical space was itself a kind of architecture, and the architecture had to become part of that. Now, you could say we've maybe haven't followed that perfectly every time, but in a general way, I think up until now we have, and the campus architects that followed have generally respected this vision, and things have stayed in scale. You still go up there, and it feels like a very special place, even though there's 18,000 student university plus a lot of big science. And an enormous amount of infrastructure, you know, sewers and electrical and all that stuff. And yet it still feels, does it feel like nature? Well, sort of. But does it feel like a park? Sort of. Does it feel like a garden? Sort of.
Well, I remember coming here back in the early 80s after I just moved to California and driving up and not being able to find the university.
Yeah.
Because it was so well disguised. I don't think that's right. the case anymore. But
it won't be after Student Housing West gets finished, because they're building a pop-up city at the west entrance.
but you know, that sort of leads to this question, right, which I think I posed to you a couple of weeks ago, which is that in doing so, in designing the campus this way, it's become a kind of a, not quite a state park, but sort of like a monument where we're disturbing, you know, what looks to be natural ecosystems becomes very controversial. And I'm thinking about the building of colleges 9 and 10 back in the 90s, right? When the trees there were cut down and Fairyland, which was, you know, this place that the students
Elfland.
Had. Elfland, sorry, Elfland. Fairyland's in Oakland.
And there was a guy living up in the tree for quite a while. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was a little later, the tree sitter. The tree sitter. But you know, every time any kind of thing was attempted on campus, there was opposition, student opposition, to the point that the university now only cuts down trees in the summer.
You have to be careful when you, especially if it's a relatively large tree.
But this whole idea of it having become a kind of a sacred space, right?
Yeah.
It seems like it's a really interesting one. And it's only something that I've sort of looked back on after 30 years. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think for many people, it is a sacred space, and they have this idea. It's a classic NIMBY notion, you know, don't change, you know, we're here now, don't change it, you know, even though the fact that we're here at all is based on having changed it radically by creating a university here.
Yeah.
And so that contradiction, Robert Sinsheimer, who was a chancellor in the late 70s, was very scathing on that point when he wrote about the students' NIMBYism, you know, don't change anything. And he would say, look, guys, why are you here? Because they built a university. This is not a nature park. And, you know, he's right. There are people who will say, you know, don't change anything, but they're wrong. And the fact of the matter is, it's not a nature park, it's a university, but it's a very special kind of university. It's not like any other university that I'm aware of, really, precisely because of this intimate relation to the environment. But what really needs preserving is not nature. But what needs preserving is a way of changing. You see, it's a way of changing that we have done. And we have somehow put a large university into this rugged physical environment and redwood and forest without wrecking it. We've changed it, of course. We've cut down redwood trees. But we haven't wrecked it. It still feels like something special. When you go up there, you feel, I'm in a special place. You know, this maybe we could think differently up here. Maybe, you know, I think there's a certain utopic dimension, which was fundamental to the campus.
Oh, yeah.
But I think there is that dimension still kind of secreted in the campus itself. We've sort of lost a great deal of the original vision, but I think the campus brings some of that forward. But I just want to underline, it's not about not changing, it's about changing responsibly and carefully. And it's about a way to change. And it's not about some pure nature, it's about working with a secondary nature, and not only the trees but the fauna, you know, I mean, it's a complex community up there, a multi-species community, and that this campus, unlike almost any other one I know, it can be considered and seen that way. And why would we want to throw that away? It's pretty darn special. It's a very special thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We need to take a break for a moment.
While we're on...
Hello, Santa Cruz. This is Ralph Nader. Start your week off right by listening to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour every Monday morning at 9 a.m. right here on KSQD. Every week, we bring you the guests that don't get the exposure and the issues that don't get discussed nearly enough on commercial radio. That's every Monday morning, 9 a.m. right here on KSQD.
From Pigeon Point to Lover's Point, we are 90.7 FM Community Radio for the Monterey Bay Area. K-Squid, KSQD Santa Cruz.
Hi, this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now. My guest this week is Professor Emeritus Jim Clifford, and we're talking about UCSC, its past, its present, and its future. So let's talk about let's talk a bit about the future, all right? Well, the present as projected into the future, because of course the future is yet to be determined. Over the lifetime, especially since 2000, I would say the environmental presence of the university, I think, has become more and more evident, in part because of growth, right?
Yeah.
And the impact that it has on resources, on traffic, on housing in particular, in the community. And the new long-range development plan, which is in development, and I understand now is not going to come out until 2021 or 2022.
If then.
Well, is premised on university growth to 27,000, I think it is. 28,000 by 2040. And so there are questions about that, which, you know, have been raised hither and thither.
Yeah.
So do you think that it's possible to put a university that large on a hill like, you know, on a site like that we have? Without transforming it radically.
Well, and without wrecking the neighborhood, there are three residential city streets accessing this university, and which have rather dodgy bike lanes on them, and we all know that there are certain times of day that you don't drive. You know, on High Street, you don't drive on, and Western Drive is a speedway, and all of that, and so it's. I can't see where another access road can be put, and I don't think. And you might say, well, they should bus people up, but then you have to figure out where in town to put a giant parking lot, and people now, unlike the original students, because when they founded it, Dean McHenry hung tough on. Cars, he said, keep them in the remote lots. People will walk. Well, that was before the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it was also before students were working part-time and needing to get out of their class, jump in their car, and go off to their job, and that kind of thing. It was a different student body. It was a different moment that founded things. Now we're in this moment, and so questions of traffic, I'm just only talking about traffic. I'm not talking about water. I'm not talking about a lot of other, or housing and rentals and all of that. All of these things which are major impacts on the community, it's hard for me to see how, you know, shoehorning or jamming in 10,000 more students, and not only the students, but all the staff and the et cetera that go with it, so we're talking 15,000 or more up on the hill with just those same, with that same, I think, I have difficulty seeing how that can be done responsibly.
The maps of, the LRDP maps that I saw a couple of years ago still showed the Eastern Access, which is coming through the Poganip up Encinal, which is right outside the studios, I think.
It's not going
but,
to happen.
but well, I mean, it's a critical safety issue as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, look, I at 5 o'clock I went up to a HISCON opening year event at Cowell, and I you know, we all know that the traffic was backed up from Hagar Coolidge Corners out of sight up toward the East Field House. You know, it didn't stop. It was all of that, and I thought, well, okay. This is a normal exodus at the end of the day. What if there were a campus emergency?
What if the North Campus was on fire?
Exactly, and it can easily, there's no real protection up there. There's no fire breaks that, are meaningful fire breaks north of this campus. So, yeah, what would happen? I mean, it's not responsible, if only for that. So there are many reasons why I think the campus is kind of getting close to or is at its carrying capacity and jamming more students in. And why is that happening? It's happening because the state of California did not plan well for demographic growth, and they only created one new campus in 55 years, and now they have too many UC qualified students in the state, and they have nowhere to put them. So their answer is we will jam them into the existing campuses. And they look at this campus on the map, and they don't see the karst, and they don't see the ravines, and they don't see a lot of things. And they say, oh, you got lots of room. Shove them in there. But the four city streets, the rental, the scale, the question of scale, which is the relation of each UC campus to its host community. We are the most, our impact is heaviest because we have a very small host community compared to, you know, LA and Berkeley and all these other places. So the relative impact of every growth on UC Santa Cruz on the town is much higher. And we've seen it. We see it in the housing crisis. We see it in rentals. We see it in traffic. So, you know, adding 15,000 more people up on the hill without the ability to get them up there and get them off safely, and without the ability, it just seems insane to me.
So the university is already spreading out, right? I mean, there's a coastal campus. I'm not quite sure what its capacity is. And students have to commute back and forth to classes down there.
Yeah.
And certain business functions were moved up to Scotts Valley,
that's right?
And so the question really is, where else can the university go if it's not going to expand up on the hill?
Well, two questions. One, unclear, but some creative thinking. There is more room down around Delaware for a bit more, you know, things that could be put there. And there are no doubt other spaces around that could be used in a nimble and creative way. There had been talk about, you know, Fort Ord, but it looks like that's off the map now.
Yeah.
So, but the premise behind the question as you've posed it is growth is inevitable. Growth must happen, and therefore, if we can't find anywhere to put it, we have to put it on the campus where it can't be accommodated.
Actually, let me interrupt, because it's not exactly my premise. Mm-hmm. My premise is that the campus is already seriously impacted by, we're going to have 19,000, we have 19,000 students this year.
That's right.
That's the cap that was negotiated in 2005 between the campus, the university, and the city. It can't grow, can't expand until the new LRDP is instituted, right?
Yeah.
But as we see on a daily basis, it's already. Right? And so the question really is, you know, is there some strategy? I don't know if there is. Can we come up with some strategy to actually, you know, based on the safety issue to spread out the campus?
I mean, I'm with you if it could be done. You know, of course, if you spread it out, then people got to get around, and it will add to traffic. And there's no everything you do has a consequence.
Sure.
We have overexpanded. I mean, the rule since I've been here has always been, all as I think you said, Ronnie, and the only guaranteed source of more money from the state is more student enrollments. That brings you more money. So you get into this strange situation, which we all in a faculty meeting last fall heard the chancellor enunciate, and everyone was incredulous. Where he basically said, we are overexpanded in housing. We have turned all the lounges into triples and quadruples. We have, you know, people sleep. We have this terrible crisis, and we need to fix it. The only answer, in other words, we have too many students for the beds that we need. So what's the answer? Take more students. Take more students, because that's the only way we'll get any more money. So it sounded like he was saying we're digging a hole, and in order to get out of the hole, we have to dig deeper. I mean, the answer to having too many students and not enough resources is take more students. So this is the way expansion, after the big money ran out in the 70s, has always been done, especially on this campus, where we don't have a lot of grant and external, you know, funding from development funding. The way the growth is done here is always you expand ahead of resources with the promise that by expanding ahead of resources, you will get more resources. The problem is the resources are never as much as promised, so you're always getting further and further behind. And that's why it's that way of thinking and that way of growing that the that's why the lounges are all full of triples and quadruples, and why the student overcrowding and why the quality of student life is just degraded. It's also why the classes are bigger and bigger and bigger. The faculty growth has not even close to matched the expansion of students. I mean, not even close. So again, the student-faculty ratio, which when I came in was always the gold standard measure for quality of education, you know, we have a good student, has gone south in a major way over the 35 years I've been here. And the presumption is always that growth means more. Growth means adding, it means more. And administrators especially think this way because they, when an administrator comes in, I'm gonna be a bit caricatural here. They think, I want to do something new, some new program, some new thing that can be my creation. Instead of saying, what does this place have that is really good, that could use deepening, that could use more support? What can I do to make what we already have better, or to protect it from the forces, economic and political, that are threatening it? They don't think that way. It's always the ideas that progress means growth, and growth means more. When I think growth is more, I think of those bristle cones up there, you know, those pines that are 2,000 years old, and who, in a good year, add there are ways to grow. There are ways. Growth is not. There are many ways to grow, and one way of growing is to thrive in place. It's to deepen, it's to intensify, it's a qualitative, not a quantitative idea of growth. And we are still under this very developmentalist, capitalist, you know, way of thinking, which is that grow is the way forward. That's progress, is more. But we now live on a planet where that way of thinking is disastrous. And we have to see there are other ways to thrive and to grow. And I think this campus is just a kind of microcosm of that. You know, we're in a petri dish here. The culture has grown and grown, and it gets to the edge of the petri dish, and then it dies. You know, but, you know, Well, that's a metaphor I heard from my colleague Lincoln Taze, who's a botanist. And he's saying, you know, well, you get to the point where you can't grow anymore, and then you die. But the point is, that's where the metaphor runs out. We're not in a petri dish. There may be limits to growth, but then you can have to learn to live within those limits, and in a qualitative way. And that's the seems to me is the challenge of, quote, if you want to still call it growth today. I'm sorry, that was just an elaborate excursus. But I do think, when I think about this campus and this, the limits we're in, if we don't think this way, it's heading for disaster.
So, tune in to KSQD this Sunday for State of Mind. Comes up next after this show, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. This month, Deborah welcomes Bill Trimpe and Birch Curry. They discuss the lasting effects of growing up in dysfunctional families, healing from those experiences, and the role that 12-step programs can play in recovery. Join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind, Sunday evening at 6 here on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, your ink spot on the radio dial. So I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. This is Sustainability Now, and I'm having a conversation with Dr. James Clifford, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We've just been talking about, smart growth. I'm not quite sure what the right phrase is, but or deepening growth,
something like that. Non-quantitative.
Non-quantitative.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, let's. This you call it a conversation, but I've been doing most of the talking. Ronnie,
that's really the point.
I know, but still, what do you think? And I have to say, Ronnie has a complete draft now of a book, which is a history of UC Santa Cruz.
It's called An Institutional Biography.
Yeah, but it's pretty impressive, and he goes into a lot of elements of what has made this UC the place it is, and why it keeps shooting itself in the foot. What are the contradictions and the it's a very hard-nosed analytical look at the utopian dreams of that are still associated with the city on the hill, you know, a Christian Protestant metaphor, if there ever was one. And so you have a lot to say, and you're thinking actually a lot more and more coherently, I suspect, than I am, about this question of growth and what the opportunities and what the obstacles are. Do you think the campus can add 10,000 more students?
Well, of course, the question is, do I think it can, and will it, right? To go back to the origin story, what's interesting is that a lot of us came here sort of inculcated in these myths of the creation,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. And it's kind of, people still arrive, you know, and it's very, I mean, sociologically,
mm-hmm.
it's a really interesting mm-hmm. phenomenon, this notion that there was this sort of, you know, magical creation. And going back and looking at the history, I see that, you know, A. Clark Kerr was really the engineer. I think Dean McHenry, Dean McHenry put the thing into practice, right?
Yeah.
The second thing is that he was a hopeless romantic in using Swarthmore as his model. In the 1960s, of course, alternative higher education was all the rage.
Yeah.
And as you
yeah.
pointed out, by the time the 1970s rolled around, students were worried fierce about job prospects and the kinds of sort of philosophical conversations. Well, okay.
By the late 70s,
yeah. But the sort of you know, Greek philosophical conversations that were envisioned
under
on the
trees,
hill,
yeah.
right, was really no longer stylish. And of course, some of these campuses have survived to the present day, but they were in deep trouble right now.
Hampshire
is in a crisis. And
how about Evergreen?
Evergreen, because it's a state university, is not quite as badly off. But
But it's at 4,000 students, so it did not expand beyond its means, I think. And that's probably a key element.
You know, and we have the college system here, which was designed to provide lower division education to undergraduates who would then go off to the so-called boards of study to become specialists. And that never really was realized. The original plan was for 25 colleges. We have 10. And as far as I can tell, there will never be a number 11. So, and they're largely residential communities now, and they get more and more crowded. We can talk about the new, you know, housing plans briefly, but on the one hand, I don't, because this is a mandate that comes down from the state, you know, grow or you no more money. The university doesn't have much choice, right? On the other hand, it's up against a whole set of pressures in terms of funding, especially undergraduate education, and addressing the demographic change on the campus, which is not cheap either. And finally, the fact that we don't have the classroom space to accommodate even the classes that we have. You know, my sort of view is that there is no other alternative under these circumstances but to start buying real estate on Delaware, on Delaware Avenue, right? I know that there was a college for sale. Bethany was college was up for sale up in Santa Cruz, Scotts Valley, a few years ago. And I guess we missed a chance because that would have been, you know, a possibility. And so it becomes more and more difficult. And of course, the Silicon Valley Center was originally envisioned as a kind of a satellite campus. And after 20 years of trying to do something there, it's really not going to become anything like that. So, you know, I don't see any alternative to that. I'm not sure the city is ready for that. I'm not sure the university is really thinking about that, right? And so I'm not, you know, and in that respect, I'm not terribly optimistic. But, you know, the response, one response has been to propose this vast new student housing project, which violates all of those principles that you were talking about, and doesn't do actually much for the housing situation in the city.
Yeah, it's unclear how much it will do. I mean, the number of students that they're required by the compact with the city from 2011 is considerably less than the 3,000 that this that the Student Housing West project envisages. And the I forget the exact numbers, but it could be quite a bit less and still be within the contract, and also solve all the overcrowding problems on campus, the lounges and so forth. That could be done with about 700-800 beds, I believe.
And so, no growth.
So the point being, you know, you need you, what I think what I hear you saying, or the part I'm agreeing with, is that at least for now we have to have a pause for we can't be adding more because we don't have the classrooms, we don't have the beds, and it's going to take a while to catch up. The catch-22 is that without taking more students, the state won't give us more money. So the solution for building, if it's about building new structures, is a so-called public-private partnership, which is the way that the UC is going, where instead of the UC raising the money, you find a private partner, a corporation, a development corporation or a construction company, and they raise the money to build. And then when it's built, they own it. And they administer it, and they collect the rent, and they maintain it. And they do that for about 30 or 40 years. And then they give it back to the university, or what's left of it. And that's the way things are tending to get built now. And that's that is the method for Student Housing West.
You know, the actually the financial structure of this project is actually a little different. The developer pays for, I think, the construction. The university has created a separate nonprofit that will own the project and be able to raise the money to repay the developer with some kind of housing bonds.
As I understood it, this separate, supposedly separate nonprofit thing is actually intimately related to the developer.
Well, it may well be. I'm sure the developer has done it elsewhere.
No, it's an offshoot. They fly in formation, these things.
I see. Okay.
So it's misleading to call it independent.
Well, this is how I understood it. Okay.
Mm, yeah.
Which then uses the rents from the student housing to repay the bonds and eventually,
that's right?
Yeah. I think it's a lot trickier than just.
Well, it's tricky, but maybe they'll do it better here. My friends in England, who Thatcher invented public-private partnerships in Britain, and they've been doing it a long time. And all my friends there, if I tell them we're doing it here, they just shudder and roll their eyes and say, "You're crazy! This is the worst thing you could possibly do." That's neither here nor there, and as you say, there are technical details that neither of us really master. But that is the way forward for building new stuff. But it really has, in my view, it has to happen in the context of a pause in growth. We cannot be adding more students for not just for a year or two, but maybe for at least 5 years, because it'll take that long to build these things. Student Housing West, which is a massive project, the first new bed from that will come online 4 years from now, if it gets going, maybe 4 or 5 years. So it's not going to help any existing student. It's down the pike. So in the meantime, something has to be done. And those of us who oppose the elements of the Student Housing West project, we don't oppose the whole thing, but we oppose some of it, think that the whole thing could and should be done more nimbly. And there are places on campus, usually called campus infill, places where smaller residential structures, 700-800 beds, that kind of thing, could be built more rapidly and more efficiently than a giant 3,000-bed complex, which will bring skyscrapers onto hyperbole, but very large buildings into this exposed part of the Western campus. And but this is all being fought about and argued about. We have a new chancellor and a new vice chancellor, and I'm hoping, and I see signs from them that they are actually not just charging ahead with the plan as that they've inherited, but they're stopping and looking and thinking. And so it's possible that some other strategies, which have been under discussion now for quite some time, that some of those other strategies will be explored and possibly implemented. Stay tuned. The game, it's not over yet. And but the longer term thing, and this that we've been talking about, is the LRDP fights that are going to go on in the next year or two or three, and in which the city will be a major player, and that will change everything. And there we really have to somehow work together.
Well, our time is almost up. I want to thank you, Jim Clifford, for being my guest today and for what I hope was a interesting and provocative discussion about the university. In 2 weeks, on October 20th, my guest will be Chris Wilmers, professor of environmental studies at UCSC, who works on wildlife ecology and global change and directs the Santa Cruz Puma Project. We'll be talking about local mountain lions and how they operate in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And remember, if you have missed program broadcasts, well, you wouldn't be listening now, I'm archiving them at tinyurl.com/y4nbrenv. And you can finally send comments and brickbats to me at ronniel@ksquid.org. So until next time, sustainability now.
We're going on a lion hunt.
I've got my binoculars.
I'm not scared. Ooh, lurking here.
What's that in the corner?
I feel two big ears. I feel one wet nose. I feel two sharp teeth.
I know what that is.
What?